Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. Good Thursday morning. This is the show here on KJZZ 91.5 with Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up today, the Arizona Corporation Commission later today will consider a new rule prohibiting utilities from shutting off customers' power during the summer. We'll also hear from Senate President Karen Fan on the contentious end of the legislative session.
For the second straight night, Phoenix leaders got an earful from people calling for some police officers to be fired. And now some officers want to see a vote of no confidence against the police chief. Meanwhile, a new council member hopes to deliver on a campaign promise to increase police accountability. KJZZ's Christina Estes joins me now to talk about these latest developments following a viral video that's gained attention nationwide. And Christina, before we start, let's remind listeners what, in fact, that video shows.
It's a bystander's cell phone video, and it shows police cursing and pointing guns at a family with young children after responding to a shoplifting call.
Now, the police chief and the mayor both apologized for the officer's behavior, and an internal investigation is underway. And now there could be more action because of a new council member?
That's right. Council member Carlos Garcia was just sworn in a couple weeks ago. He campaigned on a promise to hold police accountable and increase transparency at City Hall. He showed up at yesterday's meeting wearing a shirt that read, "End Police Brutality." And he remained quiet as the council listened to hours of public comment. People asked the council to vote against a citywide budget, which included more than $700 million for the police department. Here's a sample of what was said.
Yesterday and today was about one thing, and that is about the criminalization of Black and brown people. When they see us, we need them to not see criminals, but to see citizens and residents of the Phoenix community.
And I'm also calling for possible early retirement of officers that serve over 15 to 20 years, as it may appear that deterioration of civility begins to occur within some of our officers during that period of time of service.
People do wrong, but even when they do wrong, they're people. Don't treat them like animals. They're human beings who sometimes pay the police officers' salaries.
These are painful stories to share. They drain us.
So you're wondering why there's so much chaos and so much anger. It's because nothing is being done.
About 15 minutes into public comment, after hearing officers labeled as murderers and terrorists, Councilman Sal DeCicio had had enough.
Councilman DeCicio. I've got to push back on some of these negative comments because the media's here. I want the media to know that not everybody in the city believes this crap, because that's what this is. It is all wrong. No, you're all wrong.
Please be respectful.
We can disagree. So this is what happens.
From that point on, there were occasional boos, personal attacks, and some foul language from the audience. After nearly 4 hours of comments, Councilmember Carlos Garcia asked for three things.
And what are those three?
He wants the council to create an ad hoc committee to make sure past community recommendations are implemented. About 4 years ago, there were 15 recommendations to improve police and community relations. And according to Councilwoman Laura Pastor, 12 have been implemented. And you may recall earlier this year, the department paid $150,000 for the National Police Foundation to look into last year's record number of officer-involved shootings. Its recommendations included a staffing study, more realistic training, and better data collection, among other things.
Well, you mentioned three, so what are the other requests by Councilmember Garcia?
He asked to move forward to create a civilian review board with the power to subpoena police officers.
Okay, what kind of reaction did that get?
Well, he got cheers from the audience because that's been a big push. They feel like regular citizens should have a deeper role when it comes to evaluating officer conduct. Mayor Kate Gallego committed to calling the council together to address both the civilian review board and the ad hoc committee.
And then what was Garcia's third ask?
He wanted to find a way the council could move toward firing the officers shown in the video. And that is a pretty big ask because of the legal process. It's not just about city ordinances, department policies, or employment contracts. Mayor Kate Gallego explained how state law impacts the city.
And the city attorney explained the Arizona legislature has given additional due process rights to police officers. This legislative session, they continued to expand that. So police officers have different due process rights than other city employees.
After that discussion, the council did approve the budget, and then you heard from the union representing police officers?
I did. Some officers have asked the Phoenix Law Enforcement Association, known as PLEA, to organize a vote of no confidence against Chief Williams. PLEA's President Britt London tells me they're listening to membership, but consider a vote to be an extremely serious matter. He says PLEA wants to focus on the situation at hand and wait for the completed investigation before having further dialogue with members about their concerns with the chief's public comments.
So how does PLEA feel about the council even considering creating a civilian review board and the ad hoc committee?
London told me the PLEA board needs to meet and talk about it before he will issue a statement.
Obviously, a lot more still to come on this. KJZZ's Christina Estes, thank you.
You're welcome.
Arizona utility regulators today are expected to consider a proposal that would prohibit utilities from shutting off customers' power during the summer. The discussion comes in the wake of the revelation in Phoenix New Times that a Sun City West woman died after her power was cut. She owed around $50 to APS. Authorities are calling the woman's death heat-related. With us now to talk about what this new proposed rule would do is Ryan Randazzo of the Arizona Republic. Hey, Ryan.
Morning.
So, what specifically would it do? We mentioned that it would basically say utilities cannot cut off power in the summer, but what are some of the more specific details of it?
Well, the regulators could also issue an order that says, you know, the weather's too dangerous to shut off power at any time of the year. And so it would codify that. And really, it just brings more attention to the authority that the commissioners have to do something about this issue and set regulations and parameters on when utilities can turn people's power off.
Does it seem as though a majority of commissioners are on board with this?
Yeah, this is absolutely going to pass. The commission actually directed utilities yesterday to begin preparing their filings for how they're going to comply with this order. And that's pretty unusual, I have to say. One, it's unusual to have an emergency rulemaking where the commissioners act this swiftly on any issue. And then to tell utilities, basically, get ready for this rule that we haven't passed yet, but that we're pretty darn sure we're going to pass. So, I don't think there's going to be a lot of debate on whether or not to make this change. But there could be some amendments on how it's implemented. There was actually one suggestion from a commissioner yesterday that anyone who had already been cut off from power this month would be restored and they would not pay the reconnection fee or any other fees that APS might charge them for that.
And is the plan that, assuming it does pass, that it would take effect immediately?
That it would, yeah, it would take effect tomorrow. And then the commission would commence a regular rulemaking to not only pass this this change, but anything else that they want to implement regarding shutoffs, but that might require a little bit more discussion or research on their part.
Ryan, Governor Ducey hasn't been shy about criticizing this, even using the phrase mission creep, and happened to see Commissioner Burns on PBS last night, and he basically said that the governor needs to read the Constitution. Is this going to cause any rift? And I mean, not from the political standpoint, but actually in terms of the way the commissioners can get things done.
Yeah, the mission creep statement from the governor was bizarre. I mean, you have someone who died because a utility cut off their power, and that talking point from Ducey, it really reflects a long simmering debate between the commission and other elected officials in Arizona regarding how much authority the commission actually has. And it doesn't just pertain to whether or not they can tell utilities when they can't shut people off from their power, but also can the commission set renewable energy policy and do other things that aren't directly related to rate making. This, you know, was very strange to hear the governor say that. But that comment from him, the mission creep, is something that I've heard in different contexts over the years, you know, regarding how much authority should the commission have regarding statewide policy and how much should the state legislature have when it comes to setting renewable energy policies in the state. So, this is such a clear-cut issue for the five commissioners. I don't see a big debate on whether or not they actually pass this today. It's more of what minor changes might they make around the edges.
Ryan, quickly before we let you go, are the utilities okay, the utilities that would have to implement this? Do they seem okay with the proposed rule?
Well, APS issued a pretty bland statement just saying that they agree with the proposal. I don't predict that they're going to argue about this very much either, considering the position they're in, you know, where they shut off power to a woman on a hot day and that woman died. I don't know how they could stand up and argue, you know, for against this policy right now. We did see a little bit of blowback from the staff at the commission saying that this is going to raise utility rates for other customers because other customers pay the utility's expenses. So if the utility has more bad debt expense, then that goes to everyone else who pays their bills. I'll be interested to see how much debate that actually gets today, considering considering the atmosphere here and what actually happened to this woman. You know, it'll be interesting to see if the commission really pushes that that argument that this is unfair to other customers.
All right. That is Ryan Randazzo with the Arizona Republic. Ryan, thank you.
Yep. Have a good day.
The week began with a series of tweets by President Trump declaring that starting next week, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, would be deporting millions of undocumented immigrants. Just a couple of days later, the Senate Appropriations Committee voted almost unanimously and in bipartisan fashion for a more than $4.5 billion package that would, among other things, help fund Health and Human Services program for caring for unaccompanied children. Can that be characterized as significant progress, and does it contradict the president's comments? With me to talk about that is Ted Hessen, who covers immigration for Politico. Ted, what specifically is in this package that the Senate Appropriations Committee overwhelmingly approved?
The Trump administration for weeks has been pressing for supplemental funding for what's happening at the border right now. And they want funding for several things. They were asking initially for $4.5 billion that would go towards housing unaccompanied minors, also for processing centers at the border, which have been suffering overcrowding in recent weeks. And for a while, there was really a standoff in both the Senate and the House over whether Democrats would come to the table and agree to this funding. Part of the reason is that Trump had recently redirected billions of dollars in non-congressionally approved funds for a border wall. And I think there was some resentment over that. But the Senate Appropriations Committee has actually come to an agreement and advanced a bill that would give $4.6 billion, so a little bit above the initial request from the White House, that would deal with those issues with housing unaccompanied minors at the border, their care and custody, and then also with several other things, including upgrading these Customs and Border Protection processing centers where migrants go when they're taken into custody.
Does this actually feel like a bipartisan effort then?
Well, in the Senate right now, it is. I mean, we have an agreement. This actually passed out of committee with a 30-1 vote. Mm. So it was pretty resoundingly supported. There was only one senator who opposed. That's Jeff Merkley of Oregon. And now the question is really whether the Democrat-controlled House takes up this measure. There's been pressure from Republicans there to deal with the spending bill on their terms. And there's also some tension within the Democratic factions in the House as to whether they want to support something like this. There's some strong opposition to President Trump and his immigration agenda. But there's also this genuine question of whether there's a crisis at the border and whether it needs to be dealt with.
I'm clearly getting way ahead of the game on this. But let's say the House, with some moderate changes or some slight changes, ends up approving this. Is there any possible way to know whether President Trump would sign it?
I don't think we know at this point, but what we do know is that this legislation was backed by the Trump administration. They came to Congress and were feeling out lawmakers. This has been going on now for months at this point, this process, for what they would support. And I think the realization is that what's happening at the border, it really has evolved into a crisis. And I think there's a fairly strong bipartisan consensus on that. You have the monthly levels of people coming in is on par with the higher levels of previous decades. And when you talk about families who are coming in, they're just breaking the records of the number of families that are being apprehended at the border. So I think there is a recognition that this needs to be dealt with. I think Trump would feel some pressure to reject something like this because his administration and his officials have been saying it's needed.
Ted, there's been seemingly general clamor from the populace to say, okay, Congress, do something. Is this an indication that there has been a lot of talk actually behind the scenes that could have been leading to gradual progress?
There's been really a fiercely bipartisan atmosphere around immigration in Washington under President Trump. And, he stokes that environment. And, being on Twitter, making inflammatory statements, I think he's polarized the issue, and he's in a way, made it harder for lawmakers of both parties to come together and find common ground. Now, that said, I think there is still a willingness on issues where they really realize that a solution is needed. I think what's happening at the border right now is a great example. There was an inspector general's report a few weeks ago that detailed the conditions at some of these customs and border protection holding stations. And, you know, they're holding hundreds more people than they should be over a period of time, and also for longer periods of time than they're supposed to be. I mean, these are supposed to be temporary processing stations where people come through or there for a max of 72 hours and then move on to a different facility. But just because they're so overwhelmed right now that these facilities are getting backed up. So I think there's a recognition from Democrats, from some Democrats, particularly those in border states and along the border, that something needs to be done here.
Ted, finally, you've covered this issue for a number of years, and I wonder, we're talking about billions of dollars here. So again, I'm going with the assumption that the Senate, at the very least, when the vote comes up to the floor next week or down to the floor next week, it's approved. If, in fact, this were to go forward, hypothetically, how big an impact could it make? Because when we hear billions of dollars, we think, well, that should have a huge impact. Is this just very incremental, ultimately?
I think the $4.6 billion we're talking about is essentially a Band-Aid for what's going on. And that's at least how the administration views it. I mean, they're saying that because of the levels of migration at the border right now, this is what's needed to deal with funding for the rest of this year. And that's not even getting into the coming fiscal year and when we start talking about budgets for that. This is essentially temporary funding. There could be some long-term upgrades, as I mentioned, these Customs and Border Protection processing centers that have improvements over time that make a difference, or housing for unaccompanied minors. But I think what both parties would say is that the root causes of the issue need to be addressed. And they have different views as to what the problems are that are driving this surge in migration. But I think that the situation won't change until they are addressed.
That is Ted Hess, and he covers immigration, among other things, for Politico. And Ted, I appreciate the time. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Governors Doug Ducey and Claudia Pavlovich traded friendly compliments at the last meeting of the Arizona-Mexico Commission, but they've since had to confront a host of national political issues. Recently, the leaders took different positions on President Trump's threat to impose tariffs on Mexico. But just this week, they sent joint letters reaffirming the bonds between Arizona and Sonora and urging both countries to ratify the renegotiated NAFTA deal. Now both governors meet next week to tout the relationship between the two states. We start our report with the Fronteras Desk's Murphy Woodhouse in the Hermosillo Bureau.
Buenos dias. Gracias. It is wonderful to be back in Sonora with my good friend and partner, Governor Pavlovich.
Back in late November, Arizona Governor Doug Ducey and his counterpart, Sonoran Governor Claudia Pavlovich, sat side by side during the annual Arizona-Mexico Commission meeting in Hermosillo.
Welcome again, Governor Ducey, my good friend.
They touted the strength of the trade relationship between the states, with a special focus on agriculture.
We are on the forefront of food safety and security in North America, with billions of pounds of produce crossing our border each year.
But a lot has happened since that meeting. President Donald Trump has threatened to shut down the border on several occasions and declared a national emergency to get additional border wall funding. All of that sent shockwaves through the border region, where many businesses depend on cross-border commerce. In late May, Trump threatened to impose steadily increasing tariffs on Mexican imports if the country didn't do more to curb U.S.-bound Central American migrants. In response, Ducey tweeted that, while he opposes tariffs, he prioritizes, quote, national security and a solution to our humanitarian crisis at the border above commerce. Pavlovich released a video stating her backing of Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador's efforts to avoid the tariffs. She said national interests like jobs and investments were at risk. Neither governor did an interview for this story.
The last time they were hurt in this fashion, at least Sonorans, insulted by an Arizona governor, was Governor Brewer.
Marco Lopez, who was appointed executive director of the Arizona-Mexico Commission by Democratic Governor Janet Napolitano in 2004, says Ducey's initial response to the tariff threat came as a shock to some.
This governor had done a great job of erasing and healing those wounds to then just literally peel the scab in a matter of seconds.
But Gerardo Vasquez, who represents export manufacturers in Sonora, was not troubled by Ducey's response.
Creo que es atinado lo que dice el gobernador Ducey.
He thinks Ducey is right that security is a priority and that Mexico does need to do more to control the migrants crossing its territory. His response may have added a little stress, but Vázquez saw it as a political statement, not as a signal of dramatic change. There can be disagreements, but in no way do they destroy a long-standing relationship that is in everyone's interest, he says. Here's Matthew Casey in Arizona.
Just across the line in southern Arizona, the goal has always been to not let big-picture politics affect the relationship with Mexico, says Guillermo Valencia, chairman of the Nogales Port Authority.
I think that the relationship continues to be strong.
The Port Authority is a sponsor of the upcoming Arizona-Mexico Commission Summit, and Valencia says the goodwill that Ducey and Pavlovich have built is stronger than recent rhetoric. Polarizing politics could reach a point where they affect the governor's bond, Valencia says. Still, he doesn't think that's even close to happening. But if things continue?
I think that's always something to think about. It concerns us. But I think that's more of a footnote.
Ducey and Pavlovich share two traits, says Glenn Hammer, head of the Arizona Chamber of Commerce and Industry.
They're both very detail and results oriented.
Hammer points to progress on issues like tourism, transportation, mining, and water as evidence the Arizona-Mexico Commission is at its highest point ever. There's nothing wrong with governors having different views, he says.
You know, it's easy to get lost in Twitterville and tweets and statements. I would focus on what actually gets done.
The next chance for Ducey and Pavlovich to work together comes next week at the Arizona-Mexico Commission's 60th Anniversary Summit. Matthew Casey, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
State lawmakers spent more than 130 days in session this year, and the last several were fairly contentious at the Capitol, with negotiations over the budget and other bills really heating up. Many of those last-minute talks took place in the state's Senate, where a handful of Republicans withheld their votes on the budget until other priorities moved ahead. I sat down this week with Senate President Karen Fan in her Capitol office and started the conversation by asking, now that she's had a couple of weeks to decompress from the session, how she'd describe the legislature's 2019 term.
Actually, I will tell you that for the vast majority up until like the last 2 weeks, it was really quite an amazing session. Over here in the Senate, everybody was working very, very closely in a bipartisan manner. It did get a little challenging the last couple of weeks, and so consequently that sort of detracted away from some of our bipartisanship and some of our kumbaya-ness that we had going on, but we got through it.
Well, what happened? I mean, obviously, toward the end of the session, you guys had been here for a while. The budget was coming up. That's always kind of a contentious thing. What ended that kumbaya-ness, as you called it?
Well, we did have a couple of members that decided that they were going to go work with the Democrats to try and do some changes in the budget that they would have been more happy with. And we also had a member that had a bill that he was very, very passionate about, that bill. And so consequently, you know, from day one, when I've been down here, I have said we should be more about more policy, less politics. And so consequently, all that really, really great policy kind of got put by the side because the politics got involved in the last 2 weeks.
Now, when you're talking about a member who was very passionate about, you're speaking of Senator Paul Boyer, who has had a bill dealing with the statute of limitations for victims of childhood sexual abuse. Ultimately, he kind of got what he wanted, right? I mean, he held out and Senator Carter stood with him. Do you think that sets a precedent going forward that more members will say, hey, I want this, I want this, I'm really passionate about this, and really hold things up?
That's a good question. So first of all, let me tell you, Senator Boyer's really a terrific guy. I've worked with him for 8 years now, and he really is a great guy, and he's very passionate about what he believes in. Now, consequently, that bill, we really could have come to the same conclusion about 2 months before the session was out. So to your point, yes, it's very disconcerting about did we set a precedence here where every year now are we going to have somebody that's going to say, especially with these narrow margins, are you going to have somebody that's going to say, I'm not going to vote on the budget because of blank? And that blank might be they have a bill that they're very passionate about, and maybe it's not a very good bill. Where do we go from here if it's just bad policy, but we're being held hostage over the budget because of that? That's kind of a scary thought.
What do you try to do about that? I mean, obviously there's always debate as to whether a bill is a good bill or a bad bill. The sponsor would probably never say their bill is a bad bill. How do you try to move forward from that, given what happened this year, looking at other members who might say, I'm not voting for a budget or I'm not voting for another piece of important legislation unless my bill gets voted for it as well?
So there's a couple of options here. Number one, we are going to pull together a caucus meeting this fall after everybody gets back and the kids are back in school, whatever. And we're going to have this conversation about us as a caucus as to how we're going to move forward with this sort of thing. We are also going to start working on our budget. I have said for many years, this is, like I said, my ninth year, and I have said I do not like budgets being done in the middle of the night. I don't like them. You know, we're all afraid of, you know, things getting leaked out. Let's just get our budget together. Let's roll it out at the beginning of the year and then have open discussions. And, of course, call me Pollyanna, but I am hoping we could have that budget by the end of March. And that way we keep the bills, individual people's individual personal bills, out of the process.
Before the session started, there was a thought that in the House, with the 31-29 margin, it was going to be difficult to get a lot of Republican-only bills done, and maybe the budget would be bipartisan. Whereas in the Senate, the thinking went that it wasn't going to be that big of a challenge. Are you surprised at how much of a challenge it turned out to be over here?
I will tell you what, you know, when they say about politics making strange bedfellows, right? So, yeah, you're right. Actually, the irony of the whole thing is all session long, because we saw the turmoil going on over in the House and the 31-29 and, you know, quite honestly, a lot of the rhetoric that was going on the floor day after day. You know, we as a Senate team, all of us, all 30 of us together, we said, you know, no, we're going to work together here, because at the end of the day, we're the ones that's going to have to step in and say, okay, come on, we need to do this. So yeah, it was great all along. And then the irony is, as we talked about the last 2 weeks over in the Senate, got a little crazy. Now, I always look for that silver lining. And the silver lining was what happened over here totally 100% solidified the 31 Republicans over there.
Let me ask you about a bill that you guys passed at the end of the session that the governor vetoed, dealing with the per diem, the daily allowance that lawmakers get. You're from Prescott. You're from out of the valley, out of Maricopa County. What's the next step here? I mean, the governor didn't necessarily say that all legislators deserve this, but he didn't say that all legislators don't deserve an increase either.
Right. So, and that's kind of tough, because we are a team, regardless of whether we're urban or rural, right? Now, granted, the urban people, yes, they get to be home every night. Some of them live like literally 5-10 minutes away. But the rural people, they take a much bigger hit. I will tell you from a personal, I'm fortunate. I own my own business, so at least I'm fortunate. But many people that are on retirement or are very fixed incomes, they are having a difficult time making ends meet. At least in the past, we were able to get those tax write-offs for out-of-town work business expenses. Those all went away with the new federal tax reforms last year. So we don't even get that write-off anymore. So literally, some of our members are literally having to pay to do this job now.
So do you anticipate trying something else next year?
I think we do have members that really do want to bring this back. And as you said, the governor basically, you know, didn't just shut us down totally. He said he understood particularly the rural legislators' dilemma. So we'll come back and look at it. And it was never meant to be done at the last minute, to be quite honest with you. This was something that was done right off the bat. There was a bill out there that addressed this that had been just sort of lingering down there, because a lot of people were saying, well, we're kind of concerned about the perception of it. And it's like, okay, yeah, you're always going to have people that are going to come back and saying, wow, that's, you know, you're voting yourself a per diem increase. But remember, these are out-of-pocket expenses. So maybe that might need to go and look at it. Maybe we need to start turning in receipts. If maybe the public or the voters, maybe that they understand that better, is that why don't we turn in our receipts and we're allowed up to a certain amount with backup or something, rather than just a flat per diem. So we'll look at it. The bottom line is that there's a lot of really, really great people in this state that would like to run, would like to serve, and they cannot financially afford to do that because of it. And this would help solve some of that problem and start letting the everyday Joe Blow guy come down here and be a part of the process.
All right, that's Arizona Senate President Karen Fan. Madam President, thank you.
Thank you very much.
And stay tuned to the show. In the near future, we'll hear from House Minority Leader Charlene Fernandez to get her thoughts on the 2019 legislative session.
A new survey by the National Council on Aging, an aging advocacy group, recently surveyed more than 1,200 people aged 60 and older. What they found is that Americans are worried that the rising cost of health care and prescription drugs could outpace their retirement savings. Joining us now to talk about that is KJZZ's Kathy Ritchie. Hi.
Hey, Steve.
So I know you've talked a lot about the issue of financial preparedness as we age in the reporting you've done. But to run out of money because of health care and drug costs, what are the solutions?
Yeah, you know, if you think about it, there are a lot of Americans who can't afford to grow old. And these kinds of costs continue to go up, and it really becomes a policy issue. According to the Kaiser Family Foundation, nearly 7 in 10 Americans want drug prices to be a top priority for Congress. A lot of people, young, old, people with well-paying jobs, often have to pay a lot of money for their drugs. And seniors are especially vulnerable to these high costs. The AARP Foundation found that more than 10 million people over the age of 50 live below the poverty line. Something else this point-in-time survey highlighted is the financial disparity between men and women. And I'll let Anna Marie Chavez, the executive vice president and chief growth officer at the NCOA, explain.
In addition, I think this underscores how women are realizing late in their lives that the opportunity costs they've paid in our society, specifically that as women have progressed their careers, many of them have on-ramped and off-ramped in their career, either to stay home to take care of their children, to take care of an elderly parent or spouse. They come back into the workforce, perhaps at a lower pay scale. And so what we're finding as women reach retirement age, they have not saved as much as men in their retirement accounts, and therefore aren't able to cover the costs in retirement.
Costs such as prescription drugs. Now, Kathy, the issue is something that Republican Senator Martha McSally wants to tackle?
It seems so. Yesterday, there was another hearing by the Senate Special Committee on Aging about this issue, and the committee is trying to figure out ways to address the drug pricing system. Here, McSally talks about a Lake Havasu woman with rheumatoid arthritis. Her drug costs $5,000 a month.
She's decided she can no longer fill these prescriptions and continues to go without the medicine that she needs. She says she carries on with a good attitude, but this is really unacceptable that we're leaving patients with no choice but to stop taking the medications. We've seen reports earlier this year that 3 out of 10 adults report not filling their prescriptions.
And one idea is to provide consumers with real-time information about out-of-pocket costs. So when they get that prescription, they can discuss costs and alternatives with their doctor right on the spot. And it's something McSally would like to see happen.
I totally agree. I mean, this is where we need to go. In everything else in our life, you are able to have information, and then you can make choices, and you can do what's best for you. And so, you know, this is America. Why can't we have this tool available now? Like, how do you see this being implemented? The data is out there. The information is out there. What is it going to take to make this happen?
So, Kathy, this being America, is this going to happen, and what's going to take there?
Well, I think it's going to take support from lawmakers like McSally for sure. But if this is deployed, it would really be for Medicare recipients. The goal would obviously to have this technology available for everyone down the road. So
all
we'll
right.
see.
KJZZ's Kathy Ritchie. Thanks as always.
Thanks, Steve.
Good morning, and thanks for listening to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. Stay tuned. The Takeaway comes up at 10.
New research finds people with a higher risk of developing Alzheimer's disease may start showing changes in their memory up to 40 years beforehand. The study of almost 60,000 people found those with a family history of Alzheimer's do not perform as well as those without that family history on a memory test. Family history has been associated with the risk of developing the disease. With me to talk more about the results is Dr. Matt Huntelman, professor of neurogenomics at TGen and senior author of the report. And Matt, it seems as though it's a pretty significant finding that someone who could be at higher risk for developing Alzheimer's disease might be showing some kinds of symptoms many years earlier.
Yes, I think it's important, though, to mention that these aren't necessarily symptoms of Alzheimer's disease, but rather what we saw is that people who have a family history of Alzheimer's disease might have lower memory performance even as early as in their 20s when we compare them to their peers who don't have a family history of Alzheimer's disease.
So that really seems to suggest that if you do have a family history of Alzheimer's disease,
that could really affect your memory from a pretty young age.
Yes, that's true. And I think that it's interesting to us because it's not something that these individuals might notice. So this doesn't rise to the level of impairing your daily performance or really impacting your daily life. However, if you really test these two groups of people, you can see that the ones who have a family history of Alzheimer's disease perform a little bit worse on the memory test.
What kinds of tests are we talking about here? Like, what specifically were you looking at?
In this particular study, we were looking at a specific type of memory called verbal memory. We were asking individuals to form new connections between two word pairs, and then you had to recall the word pairs when prompted.
Now, I imagine that you would be cautious to say that just having signs of maybe a weakened memory or not a great memory early on does not necessarily mean that you will absolutely develop Alzheimer's disease later on, right?
Yes, I think that's really important for people to realize that we all have good days and bad days with regards to our memory. And certainly the effects that we're finding in our study are really nothing to be concerned with. It's just interesting that there is a difference. So definitely this does not rise to the level of what you would call a clinical memory disorder. It doesn't rise to the level of dementia, but there is a difference. And that really is the thing that is brand new with our work.
So do you anticipate that this kind of data could impact, I don't want to call them treatments, but maybe things people can do earlier on in life if they have a family history of Alzheimer's disease and maybe they recognize that, you know, their memory maybe isn't as great as they wish it was?
Well, I hope that our report really helps people understand that lifelong health is really needs to be a lifelong focus. So many of the diseases that we are really worried about that are age-related, like Alzheimer's disease, for example, the path to avoiding those starts early in life. So adopting a healthy living lifestyle, eating well, exercising, those are some things which have shown to help decrease your risk for dementia. And I hope that some of this new work just emphasizes to people that those need to start early. We can't start them late in life as the risk increases, but the earlier you start those, the better off the outcome could be.
Do these data, in your mind, strengthen the connection between family history of Alzheimer's and somebody else in that family developing it?
I don't know how much they would strengthen it because it was already known that a family history of Alzheimer's disease does increase your risk for Alzheimer's. I think that these new findings surprised us because they extended how early we might see changes. And, you know, again, these are not changes that would lead to a clinical diagnosis, but they are changes that you can find when you compare groups that are very similar, with the big difference being one has a family history and one does not.
So what kind of research do you think has to come next to sort of take what you found and then have that work toward, you know, some kind of treatment or early diagnostic tool or something else that, you know, that would help folks either who are more at risk for developing Alzheimer's disease or maybe even folks who have already developed it?
Well, certainly one of the new areas that we are focusing on is this area that we call precision aging. It's very similar to what's happening right now in cancer with precision medicine, where patients are getting prescribed drugs specifically to target their cancer based on the composition of that cancer, the genetics, and other aspects of that cancer. We think there's a significant future in precision aging by targeting those aspects of aging that are most relevant to the individual. So what that means is we might suggest that a certain approach is important for someone with family history of Alzheimer's disease, and then for their friend who is just like them but has no family history, we might want to focus on different aspects of medicine for that person to help them age as best as possible with respect to their brain.
All right. That's Dr. Matt Huntelman, a professor of neurogenomics at TGen. Dr. Huntelman, thanks a lot for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Autonomous driverless cars will be on the road soon. How soon, we don't know, but when they arrive, they'll completely change the ways we choose to get around. Street traffic will be affected, but what about air travel? Will more people choose to sit in the back seat of an automobile and be driven around rather than take a flight? Stephen Rice, professor of human factors at Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University, has looked into that and is with me to talk about what he learned. So, Stephen, I know you looked into how automation could affect aviation in terms of pilotless aircraft, but what made you interested in studying the possible impact of autonomous cars on air travel?
We just started to have some conversations in our lab about how cool would it be, really, to have a driverless car. And furthermore, what could you do with the car once it's driverless? I mean, obviously, you would take out the front seats because they're no longer necessary. You don't need to have the dashboard, the steering wheel. Basically, it would be a moving camper. You could put even a Lazy Boy or a bed in there. And we just started talking about how awesome would that be to jump in a car on a Friday night, you know, arrive in Washington, D.C. 12 hours later after a good night's sleep, watch a movie, you know, have some breakfast, and then get ready to go. And then we made that connection. Oh, well, that would mean we don't have to fly. And that's when I really started to think about, okay, so what would the consumer say about that? And that's where the research really began along these lines, is trying to find out what other people think about that. And would they give up the flying, you know, for the convenience of riding in a car instead?
So let's talk about where the line sort of was for people. How far would they be willing to drive themselves? How long a trip would it have to be for them to decide, okay, I would rather take an autonomous car than an airplane? And what are some of the factors that made them think the air travel was just really too big a pain?
The study that we ran, we looked at different lengths of a drive, like 5 hours, 7 hours, 11 hours, and so forth. And we've done follow-up studies since then looking at different time frames. And what we're generally finding is that people really prefer to drive anyway, even if they have to drive manually, if it's a short drive up to, like, say, 4 hours, 4 or 5 hours even. People just don't like the process of going on an airplane. You spend a couple hours, you know, prior to the actual flight, because you have to drive to the airport, you have to find parking, you got to go do check-in, you got to go through TSA, you got to sit and wait for your airplane. And assuming no delays, that's a 2 hour, you know, window. Then you get in the airplane and you fly for whatever, an hour or so. And then when you get out, you got to go get your bags and, you know, go get a rental car or whatever. This is a hassle that everybody is familiar with. And it doesn't take a lot to get people to think that through. When the drive starts to get a little bit longer, like 7 hours, 9 hours, 11 hours, people don't really want to manually drive because that's exhausting. They'd really rather just let somebody take them there, and so they're more willing to fly in an aircraft in that situation. But once you remove the hassle of actually having to drive yourself, now people start to move back towards the car. In a driverless car, particularly with 7 hours, 9 hours, 11-hour drive, people really want to be in the driverless car because they realize the following. They can leave at, say, 7 o'clock at night. They can watch a movie, have a drink, go to sleep, and wake up the next morning, 11 hours later, you know, in another city, and already have a car. That sort of time frame, the 7, 9, 11-hour time frame, is really ideal for driverless cars and not ideal at all for commercial flight. So I guess the take-home message here on that is that it's the short-haul flights are the ones that are going to be competing with the driverless cars.
And do you think the aviation industry is shaking its boots a bit about this? What sort of plans would they try to make to counter it?
Well, I think it really depends on who you talk to. I mean, we have talked to people in aviation who tell us, wow, I've never even thought about that. And on the other hand, we've talked to people who have said, oh, yeah, we've been considering this and, you know, we're taking steps. Now, they're obviously not going to tell me or you or the public what those steps are at this point because, you know, they keep these things close to the vest. And it's the same thing with the car companies. I mean, they're not going to share any more than they have to at this point. But I would imagine that the airlines that have the hub and spoke model, which is the model where you take the short haul flight to the hub and then you take the longer flight from hub to hub, they're going to be more concerned about this because it's those short haul flights that are going to be affected. If you live in, say, Savannah, Georgia, why would you fly to Atlanta, do a 2 hour layover when you can just have your car drive you to Atlanta, drop you off at the airport, and then drive itself home? So they probably are more concerned about it.
We all have, I mean, those of us who are over 40 have fond memories of what it used to be like to fly. And it wasn't just, hey, we're running from, oh my God, what's going to happen? The flights were a little bit more comfortable. You know, that's comfortable right. Maybe a relative word. But is there anything to counter this that, at least in some cases, the aviation industry might say, you know, some of those autonomous cars are doing some things pretty interestingly. So maybe we'll have a few flights here and there that are a little bit more comfortable for folks. And maybe they'd have to pay a little bit more, but it's not flying in first class, but it will make it so we're going to try to compete a little bit more. Not in all flights, certainly, but would that just be just not cost efficient for them to even try?
No, I think that is actually cost efficient for them to try. And I think they are doing it not in direct competition with driverless cars because they're not here yet, but just simply because there's a lot of people who are just fed up. I mean, the seat pitch on the economy class for most airlines in America now, you know, are like 31, 32 inches, which is tiny compared to the way it was when, you know, you and I were younger. So now we have premium economy. A lot of new aircraft are coming out with a good large section of premium economy. A lot of the airlines are refurbishing their old aircraft and including, you know, that extra legroom. So you can get a seat pitch of, say, 38, 39 inches instead of 30 or 31. You get a little wider seat, you get the leg rest, a little more comfort, and you pay a couple of hundred extra bucks for that. So I do think that they already know that people are fed up with, you know, the cattle class and are doing something about it for people who are willing to pay a little extra. Whether they continue towards that direction when driverless cars come around, it seems like that might be a good idea to do, certainly. If you're competing with somebody who has a bed in their car, then, you know, you have to do something to convince them that this is going to be a pleasant experience. Because like you said, it's just not pleasant anymore. It used to be fun to fly. Now it's just a chore for the most part.
Stephen Rice is professor of human factors at Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University.
So, Steve, even though we had a pretty cool start to the season, summer is now officially here.
And, Mark, summer in the Valley often means driving I-17 to northern Arizona to get away from the heat.
It almost feels like sitting on the 17 on a late Sunday afternoon on the way back to Phoenix is kind of a rite of passage for many Valley residents.
But apparently some relief, though not in the form of weather, is on the way, as Governor Ducey signed off on an extra $130 million that the State Department of Transportation needed to complete the project to widen I-17 between Anthem and Sunset Point.
Right now, the interstate is three lanes wide until you get to Anthem Way when it drops down to two. Dallas Hammett, an ADOT engineer working on the project, says that'll change.
What this project will do is it'll continue that third lane in both north and southbound directions up to Black Canyon City. So we will add approximately 13 new miles of a third lane on Interstate 17.
Hammett says that between Black Canyon City and Sunset Point, when you start climbing the hill, that's where the flex lanes will be. A flex lane allows them to switch the lane to go in either direction.
We will have gates that will open, allow that traffic. So we'll have four lanes, the two existing and the two new flex lanes to go north to climb the hill. And then on Sunday, when everyone's coming back, we will switch the gates and allow four lanes going south.
He says ADOT is preparing for the geology of the area to tell them if the inner lane or outer lane is the best to expand based on the possibility of rockfall.
The project has been in discussion for more than a decade, but they would have only been able to do half the plan until the funding came through during the session.
Construction begins this fall, will happen during the lower traffic hours. It's expected to be finished by 2023.
Well, maybe we'll both drive up north more often, maybe we could grab some pie.
Field trip.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.